Hey everybody, welcome back to the Way Ramen podcast. In today's episode, I sit down and have a conversation with Andre Key, a 20-year-old ramen cook from Perth, Australia. Now, Andre and I had been talking a little bit on Instagram before I invited him on, but I really didn't know what to expect. I mean, he's 20. How much could he possibly know about making ramen? Well, turns out he knows a lot, like a hell of a lot about making ramen. And this conversation was exactly the kind of conversations I dreamed about having on this podcast. This episode is the episode for ramen nerds. Andre goes deep into making tares, soups, noodles, all of the things that he's experimenting with. It's an awesome listen if you're a true ramen nerd. And having this conversation with him, it made me really feel like I'm not all alone in this world. You know, there's people just like me out there who are just as obsessed about trying to get better at making ramen at home. I really think you guys are going to enjoy this conversation with Andre as much as I did when I was recording it. And if you haven't heard about him until now, well, now you know him. Go follow him on Instagram. He's doing great stuff in Australia. So without further ado, here is Andre Key. So thanks so much for joining me for the podcast.
I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah. You are
super nervous. This is my first podcast ever.
You are officially my first Australian guest. But it looks like I'm going to have many more because I got some questions from fellow Australians. So.
Yeah. A lot of my friends, because I posted the Instagram story, I had a question box, and I had a few of my friends put some questions in. So yeah,
cool.
So excited for our hour of fame.
So I guess could you introduce yourself first of all, who you are, where you're from, and can we go right into like what got you into making ramen?
All right. So my name's Andre. I live in Perth, Australia. I've been here since I was about 4 years old. I'm originally from Hong Kong. My family's from Hong Kong, but yeah. I guess with ramen, my first experience with ramen probably was when I was about 4 years old, when I was in Tokyo. And I still remember it. I was so young. I barely remember anything else, but I remember eating this bowl of ramen and just remembering like, oh, it's like, this is umami, you know, this is flavor. Like it's a very distinct food memory that's very recurrent from my childhood. And I guess I kind of forgot about that for a long time. And then I started working in a ramen shop about April last year. I worked there for about a year or so. I was just a front of house, you know, like waiter, but I got a lot of access into looking at how the ramen kitchen works, how because most ramen shops are quite small. And the shop that I worked in was very small. So it was it replicated the Japanese ramen shops to a pretty good extent, like, you know, the very packed, you know, outside super packed, there's always a queue outside, you know, so I got a lot of experience with that. And it was a very very focused menu. And that's very typical of like, you know, Kodawari movement in Japan.
What style of ramen was that shop serving?
Oh, so that was a tonkotsu ramen.
Okay.
So yeah, that tonkotsu ramen was probably like the first ramen that I was ever really exposed to. And that was the bowl that I had when I was 4 years old.
Wow.
So, because it's super impactful, you know, it's really, it's pretty easy for a palate that's not very familiar with Japanese food to understand it and appreciate it compared to something that's a little bit more subtle, a bit more complex, such as mm-hmm. like shoyu or shio.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, since then I just decided like, oh, I want to make ramen. And then I kind of like looked at, oh, what do they do at work? And that looks pretty cool. And then I just started doing it. Like, I think my first bowl was like a tori python.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't very good, but you know, it's very, very typical of most guys. Like I remember talking to Ramen Lord, and he was telling me about his first bowl, and his wasn't very good either. But you know, you improve, you learn more, and yeah, everyone's just on that journey, I guess.
Every single person I've talked to so far said their first bowl was terrible, and I think Mike said that his first 6 years was terrible. But I don't really know if I believe that. Six years seems like kind of a long time. That's really cool.
Yeah.
And for people that don't know, you're only 20 years old. And so it's pretty incredible. Yeah. You know, I'm almost double your age. Literally, I'm nearly double your age. Yeah. And so I'm 37. So close, pretty close.
Yeah. So when did you start making ramen?
A couple years ago. Yeah. So the first, maybe the first time I ever attempted, there was like a shop that opened up here where I live. And I went there super excited because I had eaten ramen in Japan and, you know, in other places like tonkotsu ramen and things. And I tasted it and I was so disappointed, you know, because there's a lot of, you know, ramen shops aren't really that great. And I was like, I can do better than this at home, you know, like I felt pretty confident. Like,
yeah,
it was just terrible. Like, I was like, oh my God, it's really hard. It's a lot harder than I thought it was.
That's a very common thing. It's because Japanese food, there's so many ingredients that are very specifically tailored to elevating umami, you know? So you've got your things like, you've got your kombu, you've got your katsuobushi, you've got your niboshi, you know, those are very common. Mm-hmm. And kind of what I've started doing is I've started adapting my own cultural heritage and adding that in. So like in Chinese cooking, there's a lot of, you know, there's dried shrimps, there's like dried scallops. And I started using that in my tare, you know, mm-hmm. And it's just about learning and understanding your ingredients and just trying to adapt them. And, you know, like the most important part is having fun and like really just getting to enjoy your ramen. That's the end goal, right?
You're actually in Perth, which is like, you know, the Western Australia. And the only reason I know that is because my business does a lot of, there's a lot of my business that I'm currently running with my friends that's not ramen related. We do have a lot of fans and customers in Australia and from both sides of Australia.
Sure.
But I think most Americans have no idea where Perth is and how, you know, separated it is from like Sydney, Melbourne and everything like that on the other side of the country. So how easy is it for you to get these ingredients to make ramen, you know, these Japanese ingredients?
So I do have a couple Japanese shops around in my area. So there's one place that's reasonably close to the city, and they've got quite a good selection of Japanese ingredients. So I can get all my umami ingredients, you know, like my kombu, my katsuobushi, my niboshi. I can get my soy sauce. I can get my mirin. Mm-hmm. Like there's a pretty good selection. So one big issue is that because there's probably a little bit less demand for, have you looked for the, like the fit cut katsuobushi? Like there's certain ingredients that are not so in demand because there's not so much, like, I guess, yeah, not many people do this kind of thing at home.
Yeah.
So there's a few ingredients that I can't really get a hold of. And I was talking to Ramen Lord about it as well. And yeah, I think his solution was to smuggle it in. So that might be my next step. Might have to break a couple laws.
Yeah, I know. It's so rough. They inspect everything too. And as far as like, even for me, where I am, like I have no Asian grocery store here. Well,
really?
In Hawaii, like the average grocery store in Hawaii is more like an Asian grocery store compared to like the mainland US or other European countries. So we do have a lot of ingredients just at our normal grocery store, but you know, like katsuobushi and things like that, it's pretty hard to get like specific things. Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you go about sourcing like your bones and your things like that when you're making ramen?
Oh, well, there's a lot of butchers actually. There's many, many like quite good, like, uh-huh. artisan butchers. So like they'll have like the really, like they break down their own animals.
Oh, you know, nice.
Like I can pick my bones. Like if I want like a stewing hen, I can get that.
Nice.
If I want pork bones, I can get that, but I haven't really made tonkotsu yet. But there's a lot of butchers around, so I haven't really run into a problem per se with the meat aspect.
Mm-hmm.
Because like Australians love meat, you know, like we can get it.
It's the stereotypical like barbecue kind of stuff, or you know, I see that all the time.
Yeah. So like, yeah, throw a shrimp on the barbie, despite no one ever actually saying that. Yeah, but yeah. Like, I haven't run into any problems. Is there a lot of issues getting bones in Hawaii?
Well, it's not in Hawaii in general. It's just the specific island that I live on. It's a really small island, so.
Okay.
Yeah, we have like, there's like a pork farm here, but I haven't tried to contact them directly to get bones, but. Yeah, it's been pretty rough for me to get. So I would love to do more tonkotsu stuff, but it's just so hard to get the pork bones.
Yeah.
So you talked a little bit about how you're trying to incorporate more like Chinese style umami components into it.
Yeah.
In Hawaii, we have this, I don't know if you saw my latest video, but I talked about it briefly. In Hawaii, we all grew up in Hawaii eating this style of ramen called saimin.
Yeah,
which I know is what actually, that's like. Yeah. So it's basically if you took Chinese soups and Japanese style ramen and you mix it together, because what happened was when the first immigrants came over from China, Japan, the Philippines, Portugal and stuff, they kind of, the myth is that they mix their ingredients together and their style of making this kind of soup together.
Yeah.
So we have in Hawaiian saimin, a very prominent ingredient is dried shrimp for the broths. Yeah. it's all good, man. This is audio. So, how are you using the dried shrimp? Because I know how people do it here in Hawaii. For the saimin, what are you doing specifically with your dried shrimp to extract the umami?
Yeah, so I usually incorporate it in a few different levels. So usually I'll put a little bit in the tare, so maybe I'll soak it overnight with my kombu, you know, like that's usually what I do. So usually for my tare, I should probably preface what I do with tare. So I might take some sake, like depending on what kind of tare I do. So like maybe if I'm making a shoyu, I might take some soy sauce, you know, like I might use a blend of soy sauce, you know, I might use some whole bean, or I use like a light soy sauce, and I'll soak some kombu, I might soak some niboshi, and then the dried shrimp, I'll just throw that in as well. And because dried shrimp is quite hardy, like you can kind of cook it out a little bit and it'll still like release that umami. So usually like everyone knows like kombu, you don't really want to boil it. So yeah, like, yeah. I might take it out the next day, but then I'll just leave the dry shrimp in there. I'll cook it for a little bit longer. And sometimes in the soup, usually like I'm a big fan of doing double soups. So I don't know if you saw it, but my most recent iteration of ramen was like an abalone clam chicken triple soup.
Yeah, yeah.
So I did like the dashi component. I threw some dried shrimps in there as well.
Oh, nice.
So and then I just kind of just cooked it out. So it's really about like layering umami, although that's a super cliche term, but it's really what it is. It's just about thinking about how you can improve the flavors of your ramen while not overpowering it.
Uh-huh.
And one big thing that I think is super important is that if you make ramen, it's got to taste like what you say it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one problem with some of the shops that I've had here is that it might be tonkotsu ramen, but it doesn't taste like pork. Mm. So like, where's the pork? You know, it might just taste like a lot of miso, and I don't know, maybe this plays off on what Mike said the other time of like the commoditized shops trying to cover their tracks with their pre-made soups. But I guess it just comes with time, you know, like people just get a little bit more aware of ramen, and like we're doing this, you're doing this, that we're trying to just raise awareness of how amazing this food can be. Like we're just enjoying ourselves.
Mm-hmm. How is it in Australia? Because, you know, like in America, I'm so isolated. I don't really know what it's like in America, but I know that most people know what instant ramen is, right? Like everybody, it's kind of like a worldwide phenomenon. Everybody knows that. But I think the word ramen itself is still heavily attached to that idea of that food, you know, like when someone hears ramen, they think of the block, the instant ramen block or something.
Yeah.
Or some kind of college kid food and stuff.
Mm.
How has it been in Australia? Is there, what's the, as far as like what Australian people think about ramen when they hear the word ramen, is it still that block, or has it evolved a little bit over the last few years into making maybe more like, you know, like you said, you worked at a tonkotsu shop, so that's not block ramen. How has it evolved for you over there?
So I think it's a little bit different in Australia. So I think that the ramen association with instant ramen is quite a uniquely American thing.
Oh, really?
So interesting. In the sense that you have your like because you have your things like Top Ramen, you know, like that's just like created that cultural association. Yep. Mm-hmm. But whereas in Australia we don't have that. We have like we have like 2 minute noodles, or we have like mee goreng and stuff like that. It's quite distinctly, well, in my opinion at least, it's quite distinctly separated from a noodle soup. And to be honest, I feel like the problem isn't the association in Australia of instant ramen with actual ramen. It's that they don't know what actual ramen is.
Mm-hmm.
It's that knowledge isn't even there yet. Or it's starting to develop, you know. So it's really just a matter of raising awareness, I guess. But there's a real growing following of ramen nowadays. There's a lot of tonkotsu, especially in Perth, a lot in Sydney, a lot in Melbourne.
Really?
It's really starting to get popular. Mm-hmm. But it's there's still a very, very strong trend towards tonkotsu, which it's fair enough, you know. It's first of all, tonkotsu is delicious.
Yeah.
You know, like there's no denying that. And it's very accessible. So like I'm not surprised that it's one of the most popular styles.
It's interesting. What's your personal favorite style of ramen?
Me?
Yeah.
Me personally? I mean, like, I've been to Tokyo so many times. I think I've got to go with shoyu because, yeah, right? It's just because there's so much complexity that you can put in, even though it's fundamentally, it's just soy sauce yep. in like some sort of stock, you know, but like you can do so much with the tare, you can do so much in the soup. It's just, there's like an essence of just simplicity where there's almost not very much to hide behind. And that's, that kind of like gets elevated with shio, although I haven't had too much shio ramen, unfortunately. But yeah, like shoyu, I just really like how clean it can be and like how pure it can be. And yeah, like the last few ramens I've made have been shoyu. The best ramens I've had in Japan have been shoyu. So yeah.
Did you start off as a tonkotsu person and then gradually, as you got more into it, transition into a shoyu kind of person? Because that's kind of like my story too. Like people always ask me, like, can you do more tonkotsu? Like, I'd rather, like, it's just so much more interesting to try to, like, nail the nuances of a shoyu than to hit people over the head with the mouthfeel of tonkotsu. Yeah. And, you know, tonkotsu tastes great, but it's like, I don't know, it's kind of just like more like a blunted, and not blunted instrument, because really high-level tonkotsu does have complex flavors, but I just feel like, as far as expression of, like, what you can do with a bowl, like with shoyu, it feels more flexible to me than tonkotsu. But okay, I could be completely wrong. I could be completely wrong because I'm going to talk to Jimmy soon. I was supposed to talk to Matsudai Ramen in the UK, and he's doing phenomenal tonkotsu there. So I really wanted to talk to him about what he thinks about tonkotsu, because that's like, he does other things too. Like he serves shoyu and he serves other things too. But yeah, I'm kind of interested in to talk to him too about that, because I feel like a lot of people, like Mike, it's kind of like an anomaly where he was miso from the beginning and just stuck with miso ramen throughout the whole thing. But I feel like a lot of people, even like what David Nichijou Ramen said the same thing, like tonkotsu was his first, and then he's a shio guy. He does a shio ramen. Like that's his thing.
Really? Yeah. Yeah. Because I've talked to like a few of my friends that have been to Japan a lot, and like, it's quite common. Like even my mother, like she was a huge tonkotsu fan, but like these days she's kind of like a bit of a, she's more of like a pescatarian, so like she doesn't eat so much meat anymore. So obviously tonkotsu is kind of out of the question. Yeah. So like she really likes like shoyu and, you know, or the stuff that I make. Like I do a lot of like seafood based soups now just to accommodate for her. So it's actually I readily accept the challenge. You know, it's like, what can you do without meat? And that's a real interesting thought experiment to think about. Well, I can't use meat, I can't use chicken, pork, whatever. I've got this fish, I've got these vegetables, what can I do with it? And like, go nuts, you know.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. So I was gonna ask you about your clam. I saw you did like a clam ramen. What was that like? Was it just 100% seafood, or did you have any kind of animal bones in there?
Yeah, so that time I did use some chicken. I used the stewing hand. So my clam shoyu.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Yeah.
Okay, what was your question? So like, do you want to know like how I made it?
Yeah, because honestly, like, so I get like a lot of requests on YouTube, like, can you do this? And I'm just like a rookie making ramen, and they're like, can you make a bowl of like tsuta? You know, like tsuta, the Michelin star restaurant in Japan. They're like, can you do this? Like, I don't even know how to make a shiotare, and you're asking me to do this.
Oh, God.
But the recipes that I've seen in Japanese, so there's like some like ramen nerds in Japan, obviously, you know, people. Japan probably has the highest per capita ramen eaters in the world. They're trying to like deconstruct the bowls of tsuta. And a lot of them have said that they think it's a chicken and clam soup. Like they said that that's what it is. And he's using truffle. He's known like for truffle and the black truffle kind of thing, but actually like a lot of them are saying it's a clam chicken. Like that's what actually is making it the bowl, like a really good bowl. So I was kind of wondering how you did that as far as like how you put that double soup together.
All right. So I think I really need to start from the beginning with that one. So it was, so my first clam ramen, right, was a clam shio. Okay. So I kind of adapted I wanted a little bit of soy flavor, but I wanted like a pretty heavy seafood flavor. I wanted like that kind of, because I've watched a lot of Ivan like recently. I got his cookbook and like I was just looking at it, and I just found it so intriguing how he combined like seafood elements with meat elements. And it was just incredible. So what I eventually started with that one was that, okay, well, what if I did exactly that? So I did like a shoryu shio fusion tare. So like I but the difference there with the later ones was that I didn't infuse any clam in the tare. So some of you may know that tare is probably the most important aspect of a bowl of ramen. Because soup, at the end of the day, you're just cooking the hell out of some meat, some seafood, and that's kind of it. But tare is what actually gives your ramen like the craveability, you know, like this is what makes it addictive. So
I feel like the tare is the personality of the bowl. Like, yeah, that's to me, you know, because you can make with the same soup three different styles of ramen. If you technically wanted to, you could do like a miso, shio, and shoyu out of the same soup, but that's the personality that's coming from the tare.
Yeah, so that's super important. So that shio was good. Like I just cooked the clam in like the soup, and then like I just blended it together. But like that was good, but it didn't have the clam impact that I was looking for, that I remembered from Tokyo. You know, like trying all those shops. You know, like that really like clean, like seafoody, briny flavor profile. Like I really wanted that, and I wasn't sure how to get it. And then I think I got the inspiration from like watching a little bit of there's like videos of Tsuta, and then there's videos of like Konjiki Hotodogisu, which is like a Michelin-starred Tokyo ramen shop. So, and then I just got the idea of, what if I just use some clams in the tare, you know? And like, what if I, and then I tried that. I simmered some clams in like my, like a shoyu tare, and then I tasted it with like a little bit of the soup, and I was like, wait, yeah, it's all right. But, and then it was just a light bulb moment. And it was just, what if I blended the clams and the tare? And then I did that, I strained it out, and I was like, Jesus. Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah. So, but the thing with that was that if you got to like let the clams sit in there for a little while, and then it'll just slowly exude its flavor into it.
So you're blending the clam. You're blending the clam first, and then putting it into the shoyu tare, or what did you do?
So yeah, I simmered the clams inside the tare, and then I took out the shells, and then I blended the whole damn thing. Yeah, right. And then I didn't even strain it out afterwards, because like it just added so much complexity with the clam sitting there. It was kind of like a tea, you know. It just kept seeping out its flavor, and I found that the flavor developed over time. So like it really peaked out at around like 3-4 days, and because it's so salty, you know, like it stays pretty much forever.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's what I did, and then I kind of adapted that idea further on with like my abalone one, where I literally took some abalone livers and I blended that in, and I simmered abalone meat inside the tare, but then I used that as topping.
That's pretty cool, man. That's like trade secrets that most shops would never give away that you just spilled right here on the podcast.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, if you're trying to use my idea, like I expect a quarter for every bowl you sell.
How's that? It has to be called Andre style ramen when you're blending shellfish into the tare. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And so did you do like a clam stock too? Clam stock and chicken stock? And then
So I did. So I started off with like a dashi, you know, like just your classic like overnight soak, 176, 5 minutes hold, whatever. And then I simmer the clam in there for a long time, like a very long time. It's like close to about an hour and a half, 2 hours, and just to really get that flavor out. And I strain it out, and I blend it into the chicken broth, which I use stewing hens, which I think you discovered as well.
Yeah.
Using stewing hens is very important when you're making chicken stock. It just completely elevates the complexity, doesn't it?
Yeah. It's like completely different. It's a completely, almost like a completely different animal. It's just like an old ass chicken, you know, it just has so much flavor.
Yeah.
Years of life. But yeah. It's kind of crazy.
Mm. Yeah. That's pretty much all I use now when I make anything, any chicken broth, you know, got to use the stewing hen.
What kind of aroma oil did you do with that one? Did you do the clam aroma oil too?
I think I was going to do it like a niboshi oil, but like I didn't do that. I ended up I found some shiso at the market. Okay. So I did like a shiso like aroma oil. Like I wanted, like, because that it's got that slight peppery, like yeah. vegetal note. And I think that that really like accented like the clam braininess. So it's just, it was just like a memory from a lot of my food is just like points in time that I remember in my past, you know, uh-huh. like I remembered like shiso being super popular, like with my sashimi in Japan. And I was just like, wait a minute. Why don't I do this? And then, yeah, it was great.
That's really cool. That's cool, man. Like it's, yeah. you're so much more thoughtful with your ramen making than I am. I hope to get to your point yeah. one day. How do you?
Well, it's...
yes, no. Go ahead. No, I was gonna change topic. So you can go ahead.
Yeah. So I think it's really just a matter of, you know, I think going to Japan helps a lot.
Yeah.
You know, my inspirations, you know, huh. it comes from like, you know, watching legends like Brian. You yeah. know, Brian from Ramen Adventures. You know, mm-hmm. Watching those videos, watching like these masters cook. Looking at a few of like the Japanese resources, so I did study Japanese in high school, primary mm-hmm. school, or like elementary school, as you guys call it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so I can read a little bit, but not too much, but you know, like it helps a lot. And to just get that like actual like Japanese information, because God, English recipes, my God, like seriously. What the hell? Like,
yeah.
you could literally go on Google, right? You look up tonkotsu ramen recipe, mm-hmm. and then the first ingredient would be high quality chicken stock. What is that? Right?
Yeah, yeah.
it's such a sadness, you know. It's such a yeah. sadness that there's such low quality recipes in English, and like that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to change that. I guess I'm kind of doing what you're doing, what uh-huh. what Ramen Lord is doing as well. It's just I want people to enjoy ramen, you know. It's because I want them to appreciate how great it can be.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, that's I felt the same way, you know, like when I decided to make videos, it's like when I first tried to make ramen, I had already been studying Japanese for a few years at that point, but you know, I just searched, didn't think much, like, oh, I just search in English cuz everything's in English, you know, like recipes for any type of cuisine you can find in English generally.
Yeah.
And so I found some stuff and I tried it and it was just like so bad. And then I found Mike's things on Reddit. And so I looked at those things, but then I was like, wait a minute, I can read Japanese, but I'll just try to look in Japanese. And the level of quality of resources available for Japanese in Japanese compared to what's available in English is just like
night and
not
day.
Even close. Yeah. Night and day. So it's yeah, pretty cool. It's, yeah. So yeah. I think, you know, what everybody's doing, working together, it's kind of going to change. I think it's going to change, like, over the next 10 years. I think people will get a better understanding of what actually making ramen is. Because if you look on YouTube today, like, the top videos for how to make ramen, the tonkotsu ramen videos, a lot of them are just, like, I don't know. I won't comment on them, but I watch them and I'm like,
yeah.
I wish they spent a little bit more time researching about what they're doing and why they're doing it.
Yeah. I think... One of the things is that like a lot of people look for quick uh-huh. recipes.
Yeah,
you know, that's a real in our society. You know, like we everything is like it's time is money, and if you're wasting time, you're losing money.
You know? Yeah.
So it's a lot of people are like, you know, people are coming home from work. They have yep. like three kids. You know, like they really don't have the time that we do. You know, uh-huh. like. That I do, at least.
Yeah.
I know you have a family.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, I have a lot of time to, like, dedicate myself, like, 3 days slaving away in the kitchen. But, you know,
yeah,
like,
yeah,
like a family of three, they may not, you know?
Yeah.
So, I guess that kind of plays into it as well. So, like, people want quicker recipes. But, you know, like, it's just a trade-off, you know? Do you want quality or do you want time?
Yeah, I mean, in Japan, like, there's still a lot of those, like, 10분 de tsukureru, you know, like you can make it in 10 minutes yeah. kind of recipes too.
Yeah.
And they're okay, but, and it's kind of interesting just reading the comments for those because a lot of time the Japanese people are like, wow, this is just as good as my ramen shop and I'll at my local ramen shop and I'll try it. Like, this is not as good as a local ramen shop. Or if yeah. this is your local ramen shop, it's pretty terrible. But, you know, that kind of like, I do videos like that once in a while because I know people are looking for those kind of things.
Mm.
But yeah, just like changing the expectations. Like you said, Americans have such a strong connection to the word ramen, to instant ramen. That connection is so strong that
yeah,
changing that's going to take some time, but I think it's going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, like, I was just looking at like all the shops that were opening up in New York, and the one that Ramen Lord just checked out in Chicago, like, you know, like there's that new huge one that everyone's going to, you know, like Ramen Ishida. I don't know
Yeah,
if you've
yeah,
seen that
yeah.
one.
Yeah, I see it. I'm seeing it all over
Yeah,
Instagram all the
that one
time.
looks
Yeah.
amazing. It's amazing. Looks awesome, you know, like, and that's a shoyu, you
Yeah,
know.
it's not a
It's
tonkotsu at
super
all. Yeah.
exciting. Super exciting that this kind of bowl is getting traction.
Yeah,
I think,
yeah.
yeah, that's like the next phase is just to like move past, I guess not so much move past tonkotsu, but like increase like the scope, you know, like ramen does not need to be super in your face. It doesn't need to be like really heavy. It can be really light. You can have like a very complex flavor profile, you know.
I'm not too familiar with what restaurants in Japan are getting Michelin stars, but I do know that. Well, I just know the first couple was like Tsuta and then Nakiryu, right? Was like the second one. And both of those are, well, Nakiryu is a Tantanmen, but do you know if like a lot of them are tonkotsu or like most of the ones that are receiving Michelin stars are shio, shoyu, and so
Yeah,
I'm not
so
sure.
the only ones that I know is, so you've got Konjiki, you've got Tsuta, and you've got Nakiryu, and neither of them, none of them do tonkotsu. They're all, well, it is Tokyo though.
Yeah, that's
It is
true.
Tokyo, so it is going to be like pretty heavily geared towards shoyu. But
That's
I
true.
don't think there's any more Michelin starred restaurants. There might be some Bib Gourmand, but I'm not sure about tonkotsu Michelin stars. Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't think so.
Okay.
I need to be fact checked on that one.
Yeah, I don't know either. So let's change the topic a little bit. Like, I know that you put up some posts on noodle making in Reddit as
Oh
well. And that's actually how I first found out about you. It was you wrote like
Really?
a pretty yeah, I remember. Well, I didn't you were talking to me on Instagram and then you said, "Oh yeah, I'm Kim Jong-un on Reddit." And I was like, "Oh, that guy, the noodle guy." And that's what I thought instantly. It was like, "Oh yeah, he wrote like a pretty long thing about noodles." So, how did you go about learning how to do noodles and, you know, 'cause that's kind of like a big learning process in itself. Like most people don't think about it very much.
I'd say that's probably the most learning that I had to do. It's because it's such a different, it's almost like learning like an alien art. It's so difficult. Literally everything can affect it. Like I was talking to my uncle, like he's done like he makes coffee sometimes, and like he was just telling me about like, oh, like the temperature of the day and like the humidity, like that can affect your beans. And like that's the exact same thing can happen to noodles, you know. Like if it's winter, you know, it's a little bit more humid, then you'll need to add a little bit less water, you know. Or and depending on the noodles that you're making, you might need to change the hydration, you know. Like so the hydration is super important in the fact that it depends on how much it can affect how much liquid your noodles absorb, firstly, and also the texture, you know. So like Hakata style, like is super low hydration, it's really brittle, you know, it absorbs a lot of soup. Whereas like a miso, like a Sapporo style like ramen, it's really dense, it's really chewy, it's really curly, you know, it's got like a real like dense like texture. And it's just a lot of variation. And how I started that was, I remember looking at, I was really into like trying to do everything from scratch, because before like my first bowls, I didn't do everything from scratch. But like I've always been like really into that. Like I want to do everything. Like even if I can buy it in the supermarket, I want to do it at home, you know. So I was just watching like YouTube videos. I remember like watching like Alex French Guy Cooking. I saw he followed you the other day. I tried his one first. That was okay, you know. But like and then I was just learning, watching lots and lots of videos, and eventually I stumbled upon like, yeah, I looked at ramen board stuff, and then I found this website called like Yamato, which is like a noodle make. It's like a it was
Oh,
like a it
they sell machines, right? Like, is that the
yeah
one?
yeah 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 it's amazing. So
I think we've all seen that same website too. Like, they sell machines, but they also write the science behind noodle making on their website.
And I remember finding that website, and I was like, Jesus Christ, this is a holy grail. I literally took out a notepad and started taking notes. And then I was just like, oh Jesus, I didn't know there was a difference between potassium carbonate and sodium carbonate. Oh geez, it has different properties. Wow. And it was just like learning like that, you know. And then I was learning about, and then it's just, and you're learning about like the different resting times and like how that depends on how much hydration you put in your noodles, and then what does the resin do? Oh, it degasses the gluten structure. It strengthens it. You know, it develops it. You know, and improves the flavor, obviously. And like there's so much learning, and like, because before I had made like pasta, and I thought, pasta, it's based on noodles, it should be pretty similar. Uh-huh. Oh no.
Basically, I feel like ramen, that's like every single component of ramen is that same process of, I think I could do this. Oh no, that was pretty terrible. Like, I feel like every single, like the five components can have that exact same experience over and over again. Yeah.
It's because like with ramen, it's just, you take, all right, oh, you've made pasta. Take everything you've learned about pasta and throw it out the window. That's what you do with ramen. That's your first step. Completely remove any preconceived notions you have, because like it doesn't, it's just, it's so different. And like the idea of like, it's so crazy, because we don't, I remember reading about this, and to this day, we still don't really know why it's just like sodium carbonate and potassium carbonate that creates such an interesting texture.
Uh-huh.
Like the science is not set out on this.
Really? Part. I didn't know. I didn't even bother to look at the science. I use these things. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause I remember reading, I was reading like a lot of like academic journals, and I was looking about, the effect of alkalinity on the dough, and like it's on elasticity and like the chew, you know, like the resistance. And yeah, it's super interesting. And like, we have no idea why potassium carbonate gives a different property to sodium carbonate. And like, I was talking to Ramen Lord about this, and yeah, we have no idea. We haven't found any resources about it. And, but I guess it's something to do with like the degree of dissociation, whatever. It's some chemistry stuff.
Yeah. But, I mean, like I've read Japanese articles and blog posts about it too. And they say like, oh, the potassium carbonate will do this and sodium carbonate will do this, but they don't explain why. They're just like, this is what it does. And I guess most people are okay with just knowing that that's what it does, and they're not really interested in the science behind it. But
I guess like that kind of thing was really like instilled in me after when I remember like when I was about like 12 13, I was just starting to learn about cooking, you know. I was super interested in it, but like I just remember reading like Serious Eats.
They're
super popular. And they really go into the science, you know. Like I was reading about like Maillard reaction, and you know, like it was just like a continuous rabbit hole, I guess, from there. It was just like learning about food and the science behind it, and what makes this so good. Like, what makes a steak so delicious? You know, like why is cheese delicious? Like, how does that work? You know, it's just a continuous learning process.
So what was your like your first noodles you tried to do, and then what is it now? Like, what is your standard process of making noodles that you're doing today?
Standard process. So usually,
I mean, like, just like whatever method you're using now to do it, like mixing the dough together, or using like a KitchenAid, or using like your hands, and you know, go through that whole thing,
so
I guess.
I don't want to break my KitchenAid because I got it for my birthday. So what I usually do is I'll measure everything out with like an electronic scale. So like I'll decide what kind of noodle I want, you know, and then it'll just be like measuring everything out. And then I'll just like slowly like I'll mix up like the kansui and like the salt into like the water. And I'll like slowly like just mix it into the flour, you know, like gradually, and then like make sure it's nice and even, cover it, you know, let it hydrate. That's the first rest. And then knead it together. Usually if it's really dry, I'll like put it in a bag and I'll just step on it. And then I'll just fold it a couple times and just keep stepping on it until it's like quite cohesive. Let it rest for another like hour or so, depending on what the hydration is. And I roll it out, rest it again, cut it, and then rest it again. So yeah, there's a lot of resting.
How do you choose which so say you're making like a bowl of shoyu ramen, how do you choose the hydration? How are you choosing what flours to go into that? How are you choosing that? Is it still like, you're just like, I think I want to try this? Or is it like, okay, shoyu, I'm going to do 36-35%? Or do you have like any kind of things that you're doing like that?
Yeah, I do. So usually if I'm making, all right, so let's say I'm making a shoyu ramen, I'll usually think about what did I do last time, and how could I improve it? That's usually what I do every time when I have the bowl. So my shoyu, I didn't like how the noodles were a little bit broken, because like they were like a little bit too, like made the dough too short. So like when it rolled out, it wasn't long enough. So like it wasn't very like slurpable. So like then like my improvement was that, okay, now I'm going to make sure that it's very straight, it's very long, you know, like it comes out into like nice noodles, you know, and then I think about the chew, like, oh, last time it wasn't very smooth. It wasn't very slurpable. How can I change that? And yeah, like I did a test on it. I'm not sure if you saw my Instagram post, but it was just a test of, so there's the very common knowledge that amylose is what makes the noodles very slippery. And my intuition was that, okay, well, amylose, that should be like, that's like, if I used a low gluten flour, like a cake flour, surely that'll improve the amylose. And then I did like a controlled test where I used like a blend of like bread flour and like cake flour and another flour that I can't remember. I think it was like wholemeal. And then I did like a wholemeal and bread flour only. And everything else was the exact same. And I just found that, wait a second, the cake flour doesn't do anything. You know, if anything, it makes it worse.
Yeah.
I have no idea why. So I was like, okay, from now on, I'm not going to use any cake flour. Because I literally thought that even it completely went against my intuition and what I had learned, that amylose should improve it, and it didn't. Mm-hmm. And it blew my mind. So yeah, there's a lot of that. So like, I might think about, okay, today I'm making a shoyu ramen. So I want this amount of, I want a pretty good chew, you know, I want a nice dense chew. I want it reasonably thin, you know, to suit the broth. And then, yeah, and it's just build up from that. And then usually I'll just have, I'll take out my calculator, you know, I have my paper now. I'm just like, all right, today, how many people am I serving? All right, I'm serving like 7 people. Okay, I'll probably need about 2 kilos of flour. And I'll work, okay, let's do 37% this time. And then I'll just do like 37% water. And then I'll just work out everything from there. So it's really easy for me to measure out.
Do you have like a specific hydration percentage that you're shooting for with specific types of ramen? So yeah, you went 37% for shoyu, or like, what's your kind of like go-to percentages?
Yeah. So I don't really have a go-to. I usually just do what I want on that day. So generally, because I haven't made any like paitons for a very long time. I've just been doing so many chintons. So like it's been, so I don't really have that kind of precedent yet. But yeah, it's just a lot of, you know, I just think about what I want and like, all right, if I want a better chew, I might add a little bit more water. If I want it to be a bit firm, I might add less water. I might add more potassium carbonate, you know? So like usually what I have is I have like the bottle of Kansui, which has the ratios of potassium carbonate and sodium carbonate in it. So I just take that into account and I just add some extra sodium carbonate wherever I need it.
Oh, I see.
That's what I do.
Do you usually blend the both types, potassium and sodium carbonate, or are you?
Yes. Okay, I see. Yes. So like I usually aim for a specific ratio. So my general go-to is about 80-20 potassium to sodium.
So you like the feel of the potassium noodles better than sodium carbonate noodles?
So I find that sodium carbonate, it really depends. So like sodium carbonate, I find gives me a smoother texture, while potassium gives like a really like nice firm chew. I really love that. Like that's one of my favorite textures, is like when you have like a really like chewy, like al dente, you know?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I love that. So that's generally like the my go-to ratio. But like if I want it to be a little bit more slurpable, I might add like go up to like 70-30. You know, something like that.
Cool. Yeah. I think I remember reading something like that, where if you're going to go low hydration, for some reason, the sodium carbonate's better. Like if you're going to go into your 20s and 30s, for some reason, it works a little better. But the potassium carbonate will give you like a better chew. And it kind of like, if you're looking for that kind of feeling, then you should go more of that. I just ordered some powdered potassium carbonate. So I'm looking forward to experimenting with that.
Wonderful. Yeah. Do a blind test. That could be a cool video.
Yeah.
Like 100% potassium, 100% sodium. See what happens.
Dude, I seriously need, because every single, like I put out 3 noodle videos so far. I deleted one because I had the wrong measurements on the screen. It's when I used to put graphics and stuff on the screen. And someone tried it and they're like, this doesn't work at all. Like, oh fuck, I fucked up. And so I took it off. And then my last one, I just put way too much whole wheat flour, and I still have the video up, and people are like, I can't get it to work. And so I got to do another noodle video of like helping people, you know, just figure out how to like come up with your own noodle recipes, kind of like a definitive one. So don't follow recipes, just, you know, this is how you do it. Put things together.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I've just been looking at like people doing it in the community. And because what I do is I do a very high whole wheat flour ratio.
What percentage
do you go? Noodles, like 50%.
Oh, are you serious? I went 20 and some people said that they couldn't get it to work.
Really?
Oh, but I got mine to work just fine. So I had assumed that it was, maybe the hydration in Hawaii is the ambient humidity is real high.
Yeah.
So maybe hydrated the noodles a little bit more, but 20% was fine for me. I didn't have any problems working with it.
Yeah.
But so you do 50 and you have no problems.
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah. Well, and the interesting thing is that Australia is super dry.
Oh, really?
And, like, I've had no problems with it, to be honest. Well, I usually go, like, 37%, 36%. I've had even 35%, I've had no problems. And, like, the whole wheat flour, like, I really like it because it gives, like, a really nutty, flavor. And that's something that I really enjoyed when I was in Japan. Like, I went to, like, this place called Basso Drillman in Ikebukuro.
Uh-huh.
And they have, like, a really, like, wheaty noodle. And I really love that. And like, just kind of what I've done. So I really like that like whole wheat flavor. And like the specs, fantastic. Love it.
Cool. So I'm glad to know that I didn't ruin everybody's noodle ambitions with my 20% whole wheat. Because I liked how it tasted, actually. Yeah. It doesn't match with all bowls. Like I noticed that it didn't really match well with shio, but it would show you that that wheat really matches the shoyu flavor for some reason.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And one thing that's like super interesting with shoyu is that I've just found that like this, I don't know if it's like something incredible or like I've just like stumbled upon something that's common knowledge, but I love adding ginger, grated ginger to my shoyu. It's just fantastic. I don't know if you've tried it, but like for my bowls, like I guess it matches really well with like the seafood flavors, but like when I add like a little bit of grated ginger, wow, it just elevates it. Love it.
Oh, that sounds like a pretty cool tip. I mean, it makes sense because shoyu and ginger, like, you know, that's a pretty common combo, like flavor combo in Japan, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I've seen people like just crush like a fresh clove of garlic into it too. I've seen people do that in Japan.
Yeah. Like that gyro style, like they're really, really messy. Oh God.
Yeah. I've never tried it and I'm honestly not even interested in trying it, but I know it's super popular, but it just looks like,
yeah,
that's a little bit too much for me.
It just looks like I'm taking off 10 years of my life by eating all of that.
So I guess we can go into some questions now. I have a bunch of questions here. Well, not a bunch. Sure. I have a few, but the interesting thing is majority of people are asking a very similar thing. Let's start off with the So the big ones are, a lot of them are asking you questions about what it's like, what ramen is like in Australia. And we kind of went into that, but Ramen Lord asked, this is the first question I'll ask you. He asked, what would you describe as Australian ramen?
Australian ramen?
Yeah. Like if you had to put together a bowl of Australian ramen, what would that be?
Like as in if I had to use Australian ingredients and make a bowl of ramen.
Well, I guess it's two parts, right? Because, I'm just going to add my own take on this question too, because you saw that Mike did that American ramen bowl.
Yeah.
It was just like a heavy tonkotsu with like 20 ingredients.
He went all into it. It was like bang, bang, bang.
Yeah. So I guess it's kind of like, what is the stereotypical Australian ramen bowl look like? And also what would you make? I'll add my 2 cents in this. And what would you make if you were using Australian ingredients to make? Because I'm also interested in making an American ramen bowl using just American ingredients.
So, yeah,
two-part question.
Okay, so the very typical ramen shop in Australia will have some sort of tonkotsu with corn, woodier mushrooms, maybe some ginger. It'll have some rolled pork belly, and it will have a sliced egg in half.
Uh-huh.
Probably no aroma oil, and it will be yellow miso-style noodles for everything. It will just be the same noodle for everything, and the very stereotypical like average bowl will have no like kind of thought that goes into how anything pairs together. It would just be a complete mess. And I guess Ramen Lord was talking about that as well. Like it's just like Westerners, especially like Americans, Australians too, they really like those like bold flavors and like really intense, you know, like contrasting flavors. So like, you see it everywhere, you know, like in barbecue, you've got your really heavy, like brisket, and then you've got like your really like acidic, like you might have like your pickles, or you might have like all those sides, you know, like this real like contrasting flavors.
Mm-hmm.
And so like that's probably what comes to mind. Yeah, definitely like a spicy miso. That's that. Yeah,
spicy miso tonkotsu ramen, like,
yeah,
one of those.
Exactly. That's yeah, and it's got to have corn. Like, if it doesn't have corn, like, people are gonna crap themselves.
Really? Yeah. Corn is like that major of a thing, huh?
Yeah, like, literally, like, I my dad's friend runs a ramen shop. He runs a chain. It's a tonkotsu shop, and he's literally had people ask him, "Can I get corn in it?" Like, do you know what we're doing here?
Yeah.
Do you see how the sign says tonkotsu? Yeah. It means that you don't generally add corn to it. Yeah. Yeah, it's just stuff like that. But I guess it's just kind of it just comes with knowledge, you know. I don't blame them for it. I laugh about it, but to be honest, it's not that big of a deal, to be honest. Like,
yeah. When you first started describing, it was like, oh, so cool, Hakata style tonkotsu, and then you said, and then with the Sapporo style miso ramen noodles, it's like, oh, that's a curveball.
Yeah, they'll put corn in anything. Believe me, they will, and they'll have that pickled ginger as well. Yeah,
definitely. Oh, and yeah, always. Shoga. Yeah,
always
pickled ginger. Yeah,
yeah.
That makes sense though. Like what Mike, when you just talked about, where it's like that strong flavors, and you have that contrasting sour with the kind of like more fatty, creamy kind of food. And so what would be like, if you had to make a bowl of Australian ramen, kangaroo ramen?
Okay, I personally don't eat kangaroo because I find it's a little bit too gamey for me.
People actually do eat that. I didn't know people ate that.
Yeah.
It looks like a human. It looks like a human with a tiny head and big legs.
Haven't you seen, like, apparently kangaroo can literally box.
Yeah, that's why.
But they literally box.
Like, it would feel like you're a cannibal eating kangaroo. Oh, yeah. Like, it looks so human-like.
Well, yeah. Well, to make an Australian ramen, that's a tough question. Because the thing with Australia is that there isn't really a defined culinary identity yet. Mm-hmm. It's a very new country, so like I guess we haven't really had the time to actually develop a culture of your own. So like, surely, obviously, you have like your meat pie, your fish and chips. You know, you've got your Vegemite, but that's a lot of that is just adapted from Britain.
Because
it's still such a new thing. Like, Australia only became like independent in like 1900.
Yeah. Was it after the war?
Like 100... No.
Before the war?
But like, yeah, it's just, it was, there's not really that sense of identity yet. So a lot of it will just be based on like British cuisine, maybe like American a little bit. It's a real melting pot. So I don't think it would even be ramen. It'd probably be disgusting because... What?
Oh, that's what Mike said too. Yeah, like, at what point do you cross over from ramen to just being whatever it, you know, it's kind of ramen-ish, you know, not no longer ramen
and, like,
anymore.
Even the idea of ramen is that, to me, like, if it's ramen, it has to have the alkaline noodles, but isn't Kansui kind of Asian? I don't know how that would work, but if you're talking about like toppings in the broth, I don't know, maybe I'd have like a meat pie topping, you know, like
we could do like know. Isn't like Vegemite basically just umami?
Yeah.
So I could do that. Yeah, something
or,
with that. Yeah.
Well, one thing that I was thinking might be interesting is like Australia actually has pretty interesting herbs. Like, we've got like this thing called lemon myrtle, and we've got like finger lime. Which is like a citrus, and it, like, you squeeze it out, and it's like almost looks like caviar. It's like a little like blob.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. So like, we've got like all sorts of like herbs, you know. We've got like I don't know.
Don't you guys do lamb there a lot? Like, eat a lot of lamb.
Yeah, lamb. Yeah, lamb. But I don't know if that's uniquely Australian. But
I mean,
yeah,
but it could be like lamb ramen.
That's interesting. I think Menshaw does something like that in Japan. Sort of lamb, or was it a curry? I'm not quite sure, but yeah, Menshaw does some crazy stuff. But yeah, Australian ramen, yeah, that's a very difficult question. I don't because ramen is so uniquely Japanese. I don't think it's very easy to make it without Japanese ingredients.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been trying to figure that out too, because I want to do like a Hawaiian ramen, but it's pretty hard.
This might annoy you, but add a bit of pineapple.
pineapple and pork ramen. Yeah.
Oh yeah, perfect. And a slice of ham, obviously.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah, because I was thinking about, because recently I did like a Hong Kong style beef noodle soup, but it was like fusion. It was like a fusion of like what I'd learned from ramen, you know, like I did like a, you know, like I had like my standard like Chinese like master brace spices, which is like you've got like your Sichuan peppercorn, you've got your star anise, your something called like a chou guo, like a saoko. It's like the package says dried olive, but I don't think it's an olive. Like bay leaf, cinnamon, you know, like that kind of thing. Yeah. And you cook that for 20 hours, but then I put stuff like, I put like kombu in there. Like afterwards, like just to soak overnight. And like, I just to add that umami. And I completely get away with like the traditional seasoning, which is like usually fish sauce and rock sugar and like a bit of salt. But instead I took a page from Ivan. And what I did was, I made like a roasted apple sofrito. So I like roasted some apples. I roasted some onions, garlic, ginger in an oven for like 6 hours in fat. And then like I chopped that up, you know, and that was like adds like that really like sweet like oniony flavor, like it's a bit more complex. And then I added like a toasted katsuobushi salt, from Ivan. Like I just thought that was amazing, and it's so addictive. I add it to everything now. I'm about to make a new batch when we finish this call. Awesome. Yeah, so like it's just like I really like that idea of like incorporating elements that I've learned from ramen into other foods. Super interesting stuff.
Yeah cool. All right, so like the next couple of questions are all about the same thing, so I'll just read who asked them. So Tom from Vermont, Black Dynasty Ramen, and they both asked what's the ramen scene like in Australia, and you kind of did talk about that a little bit. And ramen Wildfire said he's in Melbourne cooking ramen. So he was kind of just asking specifically what the Perth scene is like. Have you seen Melbourne, the ramen shops in Melbourne, and compared it to it in Perth, or is it you're kind of basing?
I've only been to Melbourne once.
Oh really?
Yeah. So like I know of the scene in Sydney and like Melbourne. Like there's a lot more choice there. Like I know like there's a shop in Sydney that does like mud ramen. I don't know it's like a super thick spoon up. Stick the spoon up. Oh god. I don't know, it looks a bit too intense for me, but yeah, you know, to each their own.
Cool. Original Kano asked, well, he had asked two questions, but we already answered one. He asked if it's hard to get ingredients in Australia. And the other question he asked is, what's the average cost of a bowl of ramen in Australia?
Oh, super expensive.
Oh really?
Super expensive. Like if you get like a toxa, you know, like you get everything, like that's gonna set you back at least like 23 or 24 US dollars. Are that's probably serious? Like US dollars, I'd say probably about like $30, $32.
Oh my gosh. Like that. And people buy that? Yeah. Like people are still like oh my gosh. Wow.
Well, because yeah, the ramen craze is pretty heavy over here.
Oh really?
So like tonkotsu is just killing it over here.
Oh wow.
But yeah, it's huge. It's huge. I think it's huge all over the world. Yeah, I don't think the Chintan craze is set in yet, like as it has in Japan. Chintan is like in some areas where it's just the way to go, you know, like everyone loves their shoyu, they love their shio, you know, like Ramen Lord was talking about it, you know, like the new wave style, you know, it's just chicken, water, soy sauce, and that's it.
Yeah, I've even seen some where it's just like where they're doing shio with just like a fish and shio tare. You know, like their broth is just like they're boiling a fish for a little bit, and then so it's kind of like the exact opposite of tonkotsu, which was I think tonkotsu was super popular maybe like a decade ago in Japan, you know, like maybe around that time. It seems to be the shift has been more towards chintan.
Yeah, because I think the Japanese culture eventually it's just like because ramen is such a new concept of food, it's still. It didn't really have those rules. Excuse me. It didn't really have those rules that things like sushi and things like tempura do, you know? You know, like it's because those are so historic. But whereas ramen, there's so much variation that's allowed, you know? So I guess eventually like this, like the Korawari movement is going to set in, you know, like people are going to come out and they're going to be like, all right, I'm going to basically become a samurai, and I'm going to do it super, super focused. Yep. Like it's so focused, you know? And it's just, I think Japan has a real like appeal. Like they really like that focused, that really like shokunin, you know?
Yeah.
It's very popular in Japan.
You know? That's so funny that you mentioned the sushi thing, because I just watched, this is like a, I'm going to get us off on a tangent here, but I just watched a video about like a sushi guy, a guy in Portland, Oregon in America making sushi. I think it was on like Mashed or some kind of one of those eater kind of channels.
Yeah.
And the comments from the Japanese people on that video were just like so brutal. Like his sushi looked good. Like it looked just like, if you didn't see who was making it, it would look like, oh yeah, that looks like regular edamame, you know, style sushi. But he was like all tatted up and he had like stubble, like, you know, like facial stubble and stuff. And he was wearing a t-shirt, and instead of wearing like that stupid hat that they were wearing, you know, and like the comments were just like bashing him, like the Japanese comments. And I talked to my friend about it later, and he's like, oh, it's because there's such like a cultural history of sushi in Japan that they don't accept people messing with the formula, almost, you know, like it has to be done very strictly in a very Japanese way of sushi. Yeah. And, but ramen doesn't have, he said, because he knows that I make ramen, he's like, but ramen doesn't have that. Ramen is not held to those standards like tempura and sushi is in Japan. So
yeah,
it's kind of interesting that you mentioned
the Japanese culture is very, it's very, we do it this way and we've done it this way for hundreds and hundreds of years and you don't question it. And you know, like guys like Ivan coming out with like a roasted tomato ramen, you know, and like that completely spits in the face of all of it. And it's like, Jesus Christ, this Jewish guy from New York is outdoing us at our own game. You know, it's just super interesting because like in Japan, like the culture is, it's very exclusive. You know, like I think, I'm not sure if this is true, but I remember like reading about it. It's that like Japan tends to keep, like they export a lot of their stuff, but then they keep all of the best stuff.
I can easily see that.
So a lot of the like top quality, like Asahi, like that, the stuff overseas is generally like, except for the ones in the can, like they're brewed in the country that they're, so like Australia has a Asahi brewing factory in over in Melbourne, I think. But then like the it's almost night and day how good Asahi or like Sapporo is in Japan, compared to what we have here.
Yeah,
it's ridiculous. It's like night and day. It's like as if you're drinking a completely different brand.
Yeah, that's for sure. But I just think that's fascinating about just, you know, like I feel like really lucky that I didn't get into sushi. You know, like just having Japanese people like bash my videos, downvoting it every single time, because it really is. It's one of the few Japanese, because it originally came from China, ramen itself, the soup came from China. So I guess maybe because of that, we get the pass to experiment and play with it, but it's pretty cool to do that. I mean, you know. Yeah. Okay, so this question's kind of, this guy, Broken Anchor, he asked this question to everybody, and it's an interesting question. So he also asks, he asks, what instant noodles do you like? Or do you like instant noodles? And if so, what kind? Instant ramen?
Of course I like instant noodles. Anyone who says they don't like instant noodles is an elitist. Seriously, like it's delicious. Like, admit it. It's all right to come out of the closet now. It's okay. You know, my favorite instant noodles. Does that include like the boxes that you get from Japan, like the ramen kits?
Yeah, dude, anything. I think anything that's, you boil a bunch of water and then you put a packet into it counts as instant noodles, right? So
I don't remember the brands, but I've had a couple of those like ramen kits from like the shops, like
Ichiran.
They're pretty good. Yeah. They're pretty good. There's I think there's like a Rokurinsha one. There's a Tomita one, I know.
Oh wow.
There's a lot of them. Yeah, Ichiran as well. But I think my best favorite, I haven't had instant, we don't really eat instant ramen too much in our house, my favorite, I don't know, I've had like a few of like the really good, like just like from Japan, they have like these amazing cup noodles like that you can just get from 7-Eleven. Those are amazing. Like I remember there's Nakuyu has like a cup noodle.
That's right. At 7-Eleven, they do like that 7 and I Select series where they're doing like Michelin starred ramen shops, and they're making like a cup ramen version of that, and you can buy it for like a couple bucks, and then they pour hot water in it for you. Yeah,
it's pretty cool.
Yeah,
it's pretty cool. Yeah, there's a lot of that. So I'm a sucker for like the mix, the dried instant noodles. So like I really like the Korean ones. There's like a spicy one. Those are pretty good. it kind of depends on my mood sometimes as well. Sometimes there's also like a Taiwanese one, which isn't really like an instant noodle, but it's like dried flour, like a white flour noodle. And like you mix it, it has like some like scallion oil and it's got like some soy sauce. Those are amazing. Love those. Cool. Highly recommend them if you find them. So yeah, those are wonderful. Those are my favorites probably.
Yeah, I think Broken Anchor deserves. I kind of like said it was a troll question last time, but it actually is not a troll question because like I like instant ramen once in a while too. I just don't eat it very often.
Yeah.
Josh.
Yeah, it's great.
Joshua, how do you say his last name? Remedios?
Oh, that's my friend.
Oh, really? Okay. Friend. He says, he says ask, up, Josh? Ask how does your ramen look so good in all of your pictures?
Oh.
Does he take your pictures for you?
Yeah, he does. Okay. Hey, mate, take my pictures. That's why it looks so good, man. Thanks. Yeah, no, it's just a you got to look at a lot of shops in Japan. Like it's really a matter of looking at what other people are doing and like kind of adding your own twist. You know, it's all about putting your own character in your own ramen. And I'm sure like you can vouch for it. You know, like you know, it's all about personality. You know, like there's nothing worse than a commercialized sterile bowl. You know,
yeah.
And it's just you kind of with ramen because it's just a circle, and you have to make sure that there's enough noodles so that it props up, like the fold's nice if you're into that.
Uh-huh.
You know, like there's not too much empty space. You know, like you have everything kind of in like a nice shape, I guess. Like you create flow. You know, like that's watching plating videos helps a lot, but I'm pretty bad at plating, to be honest. Like I think plating is probably just as hard, if not harder, than making the food itself.
It's like the sixth component of ramen is like arranging the toppings on it, you know?
Basically.
Yeah.
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 What's the next question? Anything else?
That's all that I got. I mean,
okay.
And I know that you got a bunch too, so you can kind of go through the ones that
you got. All right. So, Matthew Ho asks, for you, what is the hardest part about making a bowl of ramen? The hardest part is either making the noodles and figuring out how to pair the noodles,
mm-hmm.
or how everything comes together. I think that's a lifelong skill that you need to just learn, and that just comes with experience, you know? Like, I think, Mike talked about it in your last podcast, you know, it's just a balance is super important, not just in ramen, like any Japanese cuisine, like honestly, like any food in general. It's like balance is super important.
I feel like with ramen, the balance is achieved through subtraction, while like a lot of Western cuisines, the balance is achieved through like adding more flavors into it to balance. Oh, I got too much salty, so I'm gonna balance it out with some sweet, and I'm gonna add some sour to balance out this thing. But in ramen, it almost feels like you're balancing it by. That doesn't need to be there. So take that out. And
You really got to consider every element and what it's doing then. Is it adding anything? Like, all right. So one thing this kind of plays into this is that in the West, there's a real like big like association that ramen, like if you're thinking about actual ramen, it's got to have the egg, you know, it's got to be like soft boiled. It's got to be like cut in half. But like, you know, to be honest, like sometimes the egg doesn't even add anything. Sometimes I would just ask for new egg. And if it doesn't add anything, why is it there? And like a lot of shops, honestly, in Japan, they have hard boiled eggs. Like, This isn't like an anomaly or anything. Like this is a thing. And it's just like soft boiled eggs is just one way to do it. You can have hard boiled, you can have none at all, you know? And it's just a balance, I think, going back to it is, for the balance of a bowl of ramen, it's not so much additive, it's more multiplicative. What I mean by that is that when you make a bowl of ramen, every element has to be perfect. And what I mean by that is if you have like if you screw up your noodles, you know, like the noodles are too soft or they're broken or like the tare is screwed up, like that completely brings it down.
You
know? Toppings is probably, to be honest, the least important element of a bowl of ramen. But in the West, it's the most important. Everyone loves to load it up with like, I'm going to put snow peas, I'm going to put corn, I'm going to put
carrots,
sesame, I'm going to put carrots. Like, Like, I'm going to put leftover chicken from the broth that's super dry. Believe it or not, I saw a video recipe of something like that.
Oh, disgusting. My gosh, yeah.
Like, there was a guy that was making soup dumplings, and he made, like, a stock out of chicken, and then they took the chicken from the making the stock for, like, hours and hours. This dry-ass chicken breast. They put it back in the dumpling.
Yeah, like, so you take the chicken that you've extracted all of the flavor out of, and it's just a shell, a husk of lifeless meat, and then you use that to make the, the dumpling. Yeah.
That's, yeah, exactly. It's kind of... Yeah, it's pretty bad. But yeah, it's going back to ramen. Like, it's very important to get every element, like, well balanced. And the most important is definitely the soup and the noodle, without a question. Equally underrated, aroma oil. A lot of people forget about it, you know. It makes it breaks it, you know. Like, it adds so much complexity to the bowl. If you don't have aroma oil, it's this is how I usually describe it to my friends. It's like, it's onions as well. So, like, think of aroma oil in a bowl of ramen as the bass player in a band, you know? When you have everyone there, yeah, it's great. But then if the moment the bass disappears, there's just something not right about it. It's just something's just off. It's just like it just sounds off, you know? And it's the same thing with ramen.
Yeah. A lot of people in Hawaii, when they try to make saimin at home, and I don't even know, like, I haven't eaten at enough saimin shops in Hawaii to know if they're actually adding aroma oil. But when people try to make it at home with, like, homemade saimin, they always forget to put any kind of aroma oil in it. And it always tastes not quite right. And I think that's what it is. Yeah. It tastes like, the oil itself does so much to, like, help the soup stick to the noodles and as an extra layer of flavor and mouthfeel, and like so important, and most people don't even know that it's there.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And it's especially important when you have, like, a light broth.
Yeah.
It's like in tonkotsu, you might not need it because it's so rich.
Yeah.
But, like, if you have, like, a shio, you know, a really clean shio, you need that. Otherwise, it's just gonna be flat.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like you're drinking the ocean.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, let me see. I've got another one. So, Marco Chaisa asks, "Hi, I'm from Melbourne. Where can you get ingredients? So please tell me your journey about your duck python." Okay, so hi, Marco. So what I usually do is I just go to the butcher for my ingredients, for my meat, and I've got a pretty good Japanese supermarket nearby, so I can just go to that to get everything I need for umami. And then my duck python, oh, geez. Yeah, that was... The interesting story is that idea actually came to me in a dream. You know, I woke up one day and I was just thinking, wait a second. Like, I just woke up with this idea of, like, a duck python. You know, I saw Tori Python. Like, that's super popular in Japan, but not many people do duck python. And I just decided to do it. And I think that was the learning curve in itself as well, because the first time I took two ducks and then, like, I cooked it for, like, 6 to 8 hours. And then I blended it, and that was a super intense, like, duck. Like, it was like a shoyu as well. And that was, like, really rich. Like, it was one bowl. Like, it's fine. It's one bowl is palatable, but, like, once you go into seconds, like, which we normally do when you're at home, you know, like, you've made such a big bowl, you might as well get two. Like, everyone was just stuffed. Like, geez, like, it was too dense, you know, and that's not what I want. So I my friends loved it because it's like, wow, it's like so intense, but I thought I could do a bit better than that. So yeah, like, surprisingly, like, I have a friend, like, Tom, like, I'm sure he's listening to this sometime in the future. Yeah. What's up, Tom? He had three bowls. I don't know how he did it.
Like, drinking cement.
Yeah, basically. Like, it was rich because, like, it literally solidified at room temp.
Oh my gosh.
Like, not even room temperature. Yeah, not room temperature. It was gloopy. Like, it was very, very normal, you know? And then my second one was, it was like a duck python, but then I added a little bit of dashi. So it was just kind of like the beginnings of a double soup. But yeah, it just added a little bit of complexity, you know, it added a little bit of flavor. And, like, did I tell you that I blended everything? The pot?
Yeah. I think mentioned it. I don't know if you mentioned it on the podcast, but I think I've read it or somewhere. Either you messaged me or you did something. But So you're putting all the bones and the meat and everything into a blender,
yeah,
with the soup, and just blending it up.
Yeah, and then I strain it out.
Oh, so you strain it out, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one time I didn't, but that wasn't too bad, because I removed as many big bones as I could. Uh-huh. So it's not like incredibly gritty. But I feel like even if you have like a little bit of grit, that texture is really good for like tsukemen.
Yeah.
Like a lot of tsukemen, like the texture is quite gritty, and like that's not really a turn off. But yeah, I like the second one a lot more because it was a little bit lighter. I only used one duck this time. It was plenty rich. You know?
Do you when you do a double soup, are you blending it? At what stage are you blending it in? Are you blending it before you blend everything together? I mean, not blending. Like I'm talking about. Not blitzing the thing in the blender, but like adding the dashi to the duck soup. Are you doing that in the bowl itself, or are you doing that prior to
in the pot?
Oh, okay.
So usually I'll taste it, like the duck soup. Okay, it's blended. It's there. I taste it. All right. Now I'll take out like a sample, like a bowl, like an actual my serving size, and then I'll taste it, and then I'll just keep adding it. And then I'll just test, all right, well, this soup needs maybe like 60-40. And then I'll just do that in the big pot. And then
I see. So you use like a small bowl to get the ratio, and then you just ratio. Ah, that's really smart.
Yeah. So that's what I do. Uh-huh. And so that was, and then I did like a duck breast char siu. So it was like really like very duck heavy. So it was I took some like katsuobushi and some kombu, and I blitzed it with some salt and sugar, and then I cured it overnight, like the duck breasts, and then I smoked it.
Oh, that's cool.
Okay, yeah. So it was like really like it was just, and then I just crisped up the skin, you know, and then that was just like a just pink like smoked duck breast char siu, and I used that as a topping, and I had like some shallot, obviously a little bit of grated garlic, just to like cut that fat, and some shiso, which was great. Yeah, just feeling like that peppery note really helps to cut that fattiness. And that was just what I did. And then I took some of like the aroma oil. I made some aroma oil from like the fat that I skimmed from the soup, and like a little bit of like the rendered like duck fat from the breasts.
Then
I cooked some like garlic and some, you know, ginger in there. Standard stuff. Yeah, that was what I did. Yeah, that was to, I asked my friends what they thought about it, and they thought that it was their favorite, even though like it's interesting how things go, because usually like the thing that you may not be as proud of is the one that's most popular.
Yeah definitely. Yeah.
And I'm sure you see that in your videos as well. Like you might think like, oh, okay, this is I'm super proud of this video, but it will only get like way less views than something that you weren't as proud of that you might have done earlier.
Yeah. That's for sure.
Yeah. All right. I've got a few questions.
All of my videos are, I'm not so proud of them. I mean, like a month or so later, because I learned more in that time period. Like, oh God, what was I doing? You know, like that's my life, going to be my life for as long as I'm doing this. But
fair enough.
Yeah.
All right. I've got a few more here. So Matt asks again, how much time is usually involved in one of your typical ramen cooks? All right. So usually I go about 3 days, simply because of it's not so much like 3 days straight of like me like slaving away at the kitchen, but because a lot of it is hands off.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of it is just waiting. So like noodles, I have to rest. So like that's a lot of waiting. Like the soup is a lot of waiting. So yeah, like generally, like if I, because I'm doing it myself, and I generally like tend to like spread it out over a couple of days, so I'm not really rushing. But yeah, like about 3 days. And cooking time really depends on what I'm making. So if it was like a tonkotsu, then I'm going to be cooking it for about like 12, 18 hours or something like that. I did like the beef broth that I told you about earlier in the podcast. And yeah, that was like a 14 hour cook, like cook with heat. And then it was like an overnight steep with kombu. So it was about 20 hours.
You don't use pressure cookers at all, generally, with your broth?
Because my pressure cooker is broken and it's too small.
Oh.
so yeah, we just use like this huge stock pot that we have.
Yeah.
That works fine. All right, what's my favorite style of ramen? I've answered that. Okay, what's the hardest part about making ramen? I've answered that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think of ramen making as a creative job? Oh, absolutely. It's very important to be able to kind of express what you want in that bowl, you know? When you serve someone, I think of it as like showing them kind of a reflection of who you are, you know? This is an idea that came to me, and this is what I want to show you, you know? It's kind of like with art, you know, like this is something that I've put a lot of effort into, I've put a lot of thinking into, and it's like, I hope you enjoy it, you know? I think of it as very creative. There's a lot of elements of just considering how things come together and how I can improve it. And I think one thing that I've learned from like food researching and just like learning about food is like, one advice was from, I'm not sure if you've heard of Massimo Bottura.
No, I haven't heard of him.
Okay, he's like this, he's the executive chef of Osteria Francescana in Italy. It's like a Michelin star restaurant. This man gets fully booked. He has like a waiting system and you have to book like months in advance. And like, oh, wow. The moment the tickets release for the month, they're gone.
That's crazy. Like,
and I got his masterclass, and one of the things that he teaches us is that how he thinks about food is that you have to examine food critically, not nostalgically. And that's super important, especially for Japanese food. So it's always about kind of subverting expectations. I'm not always going to be like, wow, look at me. You know, I'm not like jacking myself off like that. You know, yeah. It's just you kind of consider what you can do with what you're making, you know, like in ramen. Okay, I've got this, and this. All right, what are people doing in Japan? All right, they're doing XYZ. All right, how can I make it my own, you know? And do I need to do it this way or every single time? Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's a huge part of it. So like, one thing that might frighten some Italians who may or may not be listening to this is that I add star anise to my ragu, you know? That's a very Asian thing to add, like star anise, a very Asian spice.
It's a very Western strong flavor.
Yeah. So I just add one and I just fry it with the onions. And why I do that is that it's got a lot of sulfur. So like frying that with onions, which is also very high in sulfur, like completely boosts the meaty flavors. And that's why it's used in stuff like pho. It just intensifies it. So I do that. And yeah, it's just a lot of, with ramen, it's just a lot of thinking of how I can, I really like the idea of just putting what I've learned and like, and just kind of signposting with my own culinary memories, you know. It's something that's really big for me.
Yeah.
Okay, let's see some other questions. If you're a beginner with no knowledge, how do you get started trying to make ramen? To be honest, I'd probably start by looking at as many recipes as you can. You know, like even the English ones, you know, like you got to start somewhere. Like that's where we all started. Like I actually, you know, the first ramen I made wasn't actually Tori Python. I remember it's actually in high school. I made this for like my home ec class, and we had to like make a dish with like a friend. And I'm pretty sure I made a spicy miso and it was terrible. God, it was literally one of the worst things I've ever had. I think I followed an English language recipe. So we only had an X amount of time. It was only about like a couple hours. So it's not like we could do very much.
Yeah.
So I did like a spicy miso when I was like 14.
What did you do? They just got like miso paste and put some kind of like a tobanjang or something in it.
Yeah, that's right. And then I had like some like chicken stock or something, like some dried ramen noodles, and like I just did like a soft boiled egg and like a char siu that I just like fried in the pan with like soy sauce. My God, that thing was, if I tried it today, I would not finish it. That was disgusting.
I bet you ate it all though, because it's like, oh, this is pretty good, you know.
Yeah, when I was that age, you know, I didn't. Well, I knew what was good, but like I didn't really have that high of an expectation for food back then. Uh-huh. I just didn't really give a shit, you know. So yeah, that was funny. What was the question again?
Well, how do beginners get started?
Okay, yeah, look at as many recipes as you can. YouTube's very good. Like, there's a lot of really good YouTube recipes nowadays. Like, check out Way of Ramen.
Hey. You know?
Yeah. Go on Reddit. Reddit's the r/ramen. There's, you know, like, the sidebar's pretty good, you know. Ramen Lord's recipes. Fantastic. That's I guess those were, like, the... Those are really quite... They can be quite technical, though. So, yeah, just... Another thing that's super important is just go through the restaurants and see what you like, you know? Like, because if you don't enjoy what you like, then what are you doing in the kitchen, you know? So if you like tonkotsu, like, go have a bunch of tonkotsu. Have a bunch of... If you like miso, go try some miso ramen, you know? Maybe if you have the money, you know, like, go to Japan, you know? Try out what it's like back there, you know? It's just a real learning curve. And, you know, don't be afraid to fail. I failed on more than one occasion, you know, like, sometimes it's just, there's so much consideration that goes into it, you know. The soup, it needs to be like a certain thickness. It might look like it's rich enough in the pot, like when I made my tori paitan, it looked pretty rich, but then when I pour it out, it was like water, you know.
Yeah,
and you just need to, yeah, be wary of that. Don't be afraid to fail, you know, and just be ready to accept that, you know, you're not going to get to sutta level or like konjiki level on your first try.
Yeah, right? I feel like everybody's kind of like Neo in the Matrix, like, oh, I'm gonna make the jump for the first time, you know, but nobody makes the jump the first time. So
yeah
man, I mean, like, I think that's the most important thing for a beginner, right? Going in with the right expectations that it's probably gonna be terrible.
Yeah,
you know, if you keep at it, you'll get better and better.
Yeah, super important to know.
Yeah,
just keep at it. It's the only way to improve. Yeah, that's all the questions I got.
Cool, man. So I just want to ask you a couple more questions that we can kind of like close it up. But do you see yourself opening up a ramen shop or something like that in the future? You're so young. I mean, you have like, you know more about ramen at 20 than probably most people ever will in their entire life. I would say, you know, like just the level of knowledge that you have about it and, you know, so do you have plans to like do some kind of like thing in the restaurant industry?
Yeah, so, well, first of all, I'll just preface that I'm crazy and no one should ever try and aspire to like the stuff that I've spent so much time, wasted so much time learning instead of studying, you know. Like, I'll literally be like meant to have an exam in 2 weeks and I'll be like, sorry, bye, done. Okay, but anyway, so with restaurants, like that's really tough because there's so much business, the business side of things that gets into it, you know, like my margins, you know, it's very easy for me to think, oh yeah, I love food. Why don't I open a restaurant? Yeah, of course. But the thing is, it's easy to make something very, very good for 10 people. But once you, what about 100 people? What about 1,000 people? You know, that, then it gets very difficult. And not even that, it just becomes as the more people you're serving, you know, like the more there is at stake with your margins, the more likely you are to take shortcuts. And it's just, it's so counterintuitive because in Japan, like you've got these restaurants, like Mike visited one, which is like, I think it's called like Ramen Lab Q or something in Sapporo. And it's like, those guys use like 8 different blends of soy sauce. They like they from like different prefectures in Japan, like it's ridiculous, you know. And like that kind of thing is pretty unsustainable in places like Australia or like in the US, I think, in my opinion, because like first of all, there isn't that level of appreciation yet, you know. It's like you're feeding it to these guys that literally think their ramen is just noodles and soup, and it's and that's the biggest challenge for people to, in my opinion, cooking ramen for a foreign audience. It's that they're not coming in with the knowledge of Japanese cuisine. They're just coming in looking, oh, it's just noodle soup, I can do that at home.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, that's what I thought. Very, when I first bowls of ramen, I could do that at home, you know. Yeah
Look at us now. There's a lot of expectations, there's a lot of associations and perceptions that you have to fight against.
Yeah, and the restaurant business in general is pretty hard, but I mean,
yeah.
Like, but I mean, you guys are getting $25 bowls, you know, a bowl. It's like, that's a lot better than America where you're getting 15, you know, top end restaurants are getting $15 a bowl around there. I think Kaiser was charging, I can't remember how much he was charging at Ramen Shack, but I think it was kind of around 15 to 20, and people were like, oh, yeah, that's so expensive, you know, like,
yeah, it is
because of that, because of that attachment to instant ramen, where it's like, this instant ramen is 25 cents, it can't be, you know.
Yeah, it's just like we're doing something that's really special, you know. This takes time, this takes effort, you know. And that's something that really annoys me. It's that, like, I guess a lot of Asian cuisine, it's just meant to be cheap.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, oh, you go to a ramen restaurant, you go to a Chinese restaurant, it's got to be under $50 for four people, you know. It's, but like, for ramen, like, I'm putting so much effort into it, you know, like, there's so much time that goes into considering how everything fits together. And I think it deserves every penny. And even, and especially in Australia, where stuff is so expensive, you know.
Yeah.
In Japan, like, ramen is, like, top end is probably like 120 yen.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, yeah.
Maximum. Like, it's pretty cheap back there.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
It's nowhere near as expensive as it is in the West, because bones are super cheap in Japan for some reason.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah.
And well, ramen was kind of like food for the people after the war. Like, you know, everybody was starving. And so it's supposed to be cheap and filling. So I think they kind of kept that thought throughout the development of it. So even like the Michelin star restaurants are serving $17 bowls, you know, something like that. $15 bowls. Yeah.
So, yeah. And so, like, I don't think that ramen would be, as a restaurant, would be good for me in the sense that it's just, it's so hard to run a small business. But I was thinking, like, potentially I could do like pop-ups.
Yeah,
that would be a good idea. So like, I could use like another restaurant's facilities, and then they can advertise for me, and then like if I do a few of them, then I advertise for them,
you know? yeah
and then I get like a cut, they get a cut, you know. It's win-win.
Yeah
You know, like, maybe like do something that like Mike's doing, you know, like you have your tickets that, like, you have like, oh, maybe I'll sell 200 tickets and I'll have 200 people come in, and that's it. And like, after I'm done, that's it. Like, I think that's pretty, as a hobby, you know, maybe as like a side hustle or something, that could be fun, you know. Like, but obviously it's not the most secure thing if I'm going to do it full time. So it's not in my consideration right now, is like how I'd answer that question. So yeah, I'm and another thing with food is that I really like cooking for people and seeing their reaction. Like, a lot of food is that I can see that they're enjoying it, and then that's kind of more enjoyable than eating the food itself.
Yeah, I agree.
It's a sense.
I talked to Mike about that, and he said, like, I told him, I actually enjoy making ramen a lot more than eating it. And he's like, really? That's weird. It's kind of like, because he loves ramen just so much, like both sides of it, you know, like he loves eating it and loves making it. And but I would much rather make it, watch someone eat it, than eat it myself. You know, like, that's kind of completely how I feel too.
I'd love both, but I love both. Like, I've always had like this dream of like, oh, I'm going to go to Japan for like 3 weeks, and I'm just going to eat ramen for like pretty much every day. And I would just learn it as much as I can. And I think that'd be amazing. But yeah, so like pop-ups, probably that'd be pretty interesting. I think that's how I'd answer that.
Yeah, that's kind of like the tragedy of the people, you know, kind of like us. Well, you know, it's kind of generous putting myself into the same category as you guys, but like, you know, you have so much passion for this and you spend so much time and effort making something good, but the end consumer will never understand the effort that goes into it. And they would they're completely okay with eating soup, pre-made soup bases, and you know, things like that, which are pretty good and good enough, you know. Yeah, so it's kind of like that whole tragedy of that. I wonder if that
really is such a sadness. Yeah,
I wonder if that can change in the future. It might change in the future, because, you know, I was talking about sushi in America, where it was like California roll and those group of things, and now it's kind of like people eat all kinds of different things. Dragon roll, let me put a ton of mayonnaise on rice, and you know,
like Philadelphia roll with like cream cheese and stuff.
Yeah, but now, you know, it's changed a little bit. So
yeah,
I know.
Yeah. It has. People are starting to get like the appreciation for like nigiri, you know, like traditional styles. And you know, like, I think it's just a matter of that country's culture becoming a little bit more prevalent in the Western society. So like, you've seen it with the Italians, you've seen it with the French.
It's back true.
Then when, like, in the early like 20th century when like the Italians were just entering into New York and Brooklyn and stuff, like people were like everyone was just criticizing their food. Oh, it's too much garlic, you know, too much this and that. It's too heavy. It's poor people's food because they were immigrants.
Yeah.
But then now look at Italian food now. It's
ubiquitous in America. It is, you know, like it's absolutely American. Yeah.
Like you think New York, you think pizza.
Yep.
You think pasta. You think Chicago, you might think like deep dish pizza.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's very entrenched into American culture now. And you can ask like anyone, like most people on the street in America, and you just ask them like name 3 types of pasta, and they could do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Easily. But then like ask them to name like 3 types of ramen. You know, like 3 types, sorry, types of like
top ramen, Maruchan ramen, cup noodle.
it's just a matter of like that culture becoming a little bit more like prevalent, and you can see it, like people are really starting to appreciate good quality sushi.
Mm.
You know, it's absolutely happening. It just takes time, you know. It'll happen, you know. I have no doubt in it.
This is a terrible last question, so this is not going to be the last question, but do the restaurants in Australia use those pre-made soup bases too that Mike was talking about?
Yeah.
I didn't even know those things existed until like I started doing this podcast, and then everybody's like, oh yeah, everybody uses it. And then there was a ramen, like kind of like a pop-up, but not a pop-up. She just was like running almost like a yatai kind of thing, this lady from Japan. And I was like, oh, I love making ramen. So I went to go talk to her and stuff. And I was like trying to sneak a peek what she was doing with her broth and stuff, you know, like, cause I was interested. She kind of blocked me. And now that I'm like in, you know, retrospect, like she probably was using like those pre-made soup bases and stuff. Cause like, how can you have 5 different types of ramen in a tent? You know, how can you have tonkotsu ramen, shoyu ramen, shio ramen, you know, miso ramen?
it's pretty difficult, you know?
Yeah. And to have like in a tent. Yeah.
A lot of shops here, like I would think that the soup bases, because it's very like the taste is quite similar.
Uh-huh.
It's just like, wait a second, this tastes exactly like that other shop, you know. And I can never remember the other shop because they all look the same. They all taste the same. You know, it's got that corn, you know,
the corn.
The tonkotsu. It just tastes the same, you know. And yeah, I'd say a lot of them do soup bases
because
it's just when you have a shop that does tempura sushi, you know, udon, ramen. How good can you be at all of those things?
It's hard enough to get good at one of them.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. It takes a lifetime to learn how to make sushi, you know.
Yeah.
How can you learn all 5 of those things, you know? And I remember Anthony Bourdain was talking about it on his show one time, and it was talking about why is this shop selling sushi and tacos and everything, all this stuff at the same time. While I'm at the sushi bar, there's a couple next to me eating tacos. What's up with that?
Yeah.
It's like when you see something like that, a restaurant like that, run away.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
There is no way that they are that good at everything on the menu.
That's true. Yeah. Cool.
Yeah, it's super important to know stuff like that.
So I guess for the last question, like, what do you have planned for 2020? We're kind of winding down 2019. Like, do you have any big goals or any kind of thing you want to try in 2020 or put out?
Like ramen wise?
Or just life in general. You graduating college or something, you know, ramen wise.
I really want to. I've been planning a few goals. You know, I've been thinking of like a chicken, like a tori python, but with like a fish element in it. Maybe like some sea bream soup.
Oh, nice!
Like that's pretty popular in Japan. So with like some sort of niboshi oil or something, and maybe like a tantan men. I really want to do that, but with the python, you know, stuff like that. I guess goals. I don't know. I don't really like to think too far ahead. I just go with. I said small goals. I don't really go that far. Right now, I've been doing a lot of like meditation, and you know, I've been watching a lot of like self-help. Like there's this guy that my friend recommended, like Tony Robbins. He's a really he's a really good guy, like to watch for like self-help, you know, like how do you improve your mood with like movement. So like you know, like a lot of stuff about like just improving my own like general like health, you know, exercise, you know, improving my relationship with my family, or like with my girlfriend, or you know, like stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
That, yeah, especially like with my family, because like sometimes Yeah, like with Hong Kong, I'm sure you know about it. Yeah, gets a bit complicated. I'm not going to go too far into it. But sometimes, like, all I'm going to say is that shit gets heated sometimes.
Yeah, especially, I can imagine.
With the older generation, like, but yeah, this is a ramen podcast, not
political podcast. Yeah,
yeah,
I honestly don't know much about. I don't really watch the news, so I don't know much about it. But I do know that something is happening there. That's not very doesn't look very fun to be around. So I can't even imagine. Yeah,
just found out about Hong Kong. That shit sucks, man. yeah. It's pretty sad.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I can imagine. If that's where you're from, I can imagine, you know, like that's your hometown technically.
Yeah, ramen's super popular in Hong Kong as well. Like, it's a huge thing there. But yeah, bringing it back to Perth, I guess there's, you know, like Bariuma.
No,
like
I don't know.
There's like a chain from Japan. Like they come to Perth, but like even they use like pre-made like soup packs.
Oh,
I guess
you're
it's like essentially. I've literally seen them do it. Like. They have like a window kitchen. I've literally seen them like pour it like a silver bag like into like a pot. Like they do it. Yeah. You know, it's I guess it's they probably have like the centralized kitchen.
Ship
everything out. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's technically their soup still, but it is like they're not making it in house.
Yeah. 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 That's one of the things that like Mike talked about, you know, like once you have a chain, it's just kind of inevitable that you're going to decrease the quality.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's what happens.
Cool, man. Well, this has been really fun. We went an hour and a half. I mean, I think you were so nervous in the beginning, but you did great. I think it was a really fun podcast. So definitely have you back on in the future. And
that'd be great. I'd love to.
Yeah, cool, man. All right, I don't have anything else to say. You have anything else? Do you want to shout out to anybody?
No, I think I've done more than enough shout outs.
Yeah, I'm sure Mike will listen to this and he'll appreciate all the shout outs that he got.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I mean, like I talk to him a lot, so like it's just like he's a huge help whenever I'm making anything, you know. I always message him, like about like, oh, what do you think of this? Like, can you give me some advice? Like, he's great, wonderful guy.
Cool, man. All right. Well, thanks. Yeah. Thanks everybody for listening. And this was Andre here in Australia, just 20 years old, fantastic ramen chef, coming up and coming guy. So check him out on his Instagram. What's your Instagram, by the way?
AndreKey1202.
Okay. We'll link it up in the show notes if you guys can remember that. Yeah. So I'll see you guys all in the next one. Once again, thank you so much to Andre for coming on the show. I had a blast talking to him. Please give him a follow on Instagram. It's at Andre1202. At Andre1202. Operators are standing by for your donations. I'm just joking. Anyways, if you guys want to join the conversation that we had, you can do so by leaving a comment on the Way of Ramen blog. That's where I post all of these episodes to get it onto Spotify, to get it onto iTunes, to get it onto Google Podcasts. Just go to wayoframen.com/blog. You'll see the post there. You can leave a comment and everybody will be able to see it in perpetuity, and you'll be forever remembered for leaving your 2 cents when the episode came out. Thank you guys all so much for listening. If you guys have any suggestions for future guests you'd like to see on the podcast, please hit me up on Instagram or send me email or wherever I am on the internet. If you send me a message, I will read it and I'll try my best to get them on the show. See you guys all in the next episode. Peace.